If you want to be at the tip of the spear of sports performance, the answer is simple. Simply Faster is your insider's edge to maximize results with the highest quality premier sports equipment in the business. Visit Simply Faster and level up. Welcome everyone to the Companions of the Compendium podcast. Today I have an absolute treat. I have Coach Al Vermeil, who's been in the game for over 50 years, probably doesn't need any introduction, but a quick Google will show you numerous NBA championships and NFL championships. He's been involved in strength and conditioning since an athlete in Utah, and also now still working with people in college and in baseball. Every one of the major sports Al Vermeil has been a part of. He is known amongst numerous circles as kind of the Professor Emeritus of all things strength and conditioning. Al, it is an absolute pleasure to have you on. How are we doing this evening?
Fine. And if your audience buys that intro, I'll sell them some beachfront property in Alaska that's great for surfing.
I'm so happy we had an opportunity to talk. I know that our schedules have been kind of like two ships passing in the night. So this is an absolute pleasure to finally get down and spend some time with you. And in many ways, I know my audience is really enjoying a lot of the podcasts that I've done so far. But for me, it's a lot of fun because I get to talk to, you know, great coaches that I've looked up to for a really long time. And I get to learn just as much as the audience gets to learn. So it's a double benefit. You know, it's a really a great honor. So I appreciate you being here. So getting into it. Talk to our audience about your evolution as a coach in your early formative years. How have you developed and evolved over time? And what are some of the bedrocks that you still maintain in your training philosophy today that was a part of those original early years?
Well, basically, I was a high school athlete at a very small school, Calistoga High School, and I played all the sports at least one year, all four, and then I concentrated on baseball and track and football. And then in my senior year, I got rid of baseball. I was a high school shot putter, threw it 54-9 in California, though that didn't get you to the state meet even. And I, you know, I sprinted a little bit and I was played catcher. And then I went to junior college. I sat out a year because in those years you had to go within your three districts. I sat out and played a redshirt at San Mateo when Dick was an assistant. He went back to Napa JC where he and my brother Stan had played and were both all league. And they hadn't had a winning season until the two of them had played there in 55. Dick came back in 64. We played for the conference championship in standing room only, unfortunately lost. And if you look at Dick's resume, that's the only championship he didn't win. And I was playing for him. So that might have told us we had the wrong guys playing for him. But then I went to Utah State. I played 3 years there at middle linebacker. And, you know, I wasn't anything fabulous. The only thing that I was able to accomplish was I started 30 straight games. And that at that time was the school records. At least that's what I was told. And then I went to Castle Robley High School. And the coach said, well, you lifted weights, you run the off-season program. So that's where I really first got into it. When I played, I'd come from the generation right when they started to go one place. Platoon football. When I played high school and junior college, I played both ways. And the year before I went to Utah State, they were still playing both ways. So my conditioning, what I learned then is I would run wind sprints all summer. I would start with 10 50s because that was the marker then, not the 40. And I'd work up to 20 and I'd run them five times a week. And I figured out one time I ran 36,000 yards of sprints in the summer. So I was in good shape. And then I lifted. And my basic first weightlifting program came from a gentleman named Bill Wood. He was my brother's high school coach in 53 and 54. He had played on the great COP, later UOP team, in 1949. They were undefeated and didn't go to a bowl game because none of the big schools wanted to play a school with 1,500 people. And they had many guys go off that squad and play pro football. And thank Coach Wood, because that really got me started. My parents got the set of weights. I trained through high school, trained. And basically at those days, you know, we did the typical, my Olympic lifts, I knew what they were, but didn't know how to do them. My power clean was the ugliest reverse curl you ever saw. And that's why when I started coaching, I knew there had to be better ways. Like we never had a light day. You went in and you know, there was no such thing. We did the Bulgarian before there was Bulgarian. I mean, we just, you know, if you handled X for a certain point, you went in and did it every day, every time you did that lift. When I got to high school and started coaching, I realized the kids all didn't get as strong quickly as I did. But I came from a very, my dad was, had a 19 and a half inch neck. I mean, he was, his jaw, you know, you talk about testosterone and hair, they called him the bear. So, and my brothers were very strong. I said I could walk through a weight room and get strong. And so I had to learn, you know, why were these kids getting strong, you know, and we had the typical basic program, nothing outstanding. I went for 1 year to Kansas State and worked for Vince Gibson. And that's where I watched them run their off season, brought the, a lot of the things they did back to the 30 stacking stations and what they call floating sprints, they called ins and outs and discipline. And when I went back to Casa Roble, I integrated that along with my assistant, not my assistant, we were co-coaches, the late Al Toledo. And I worked we worked all the summers and then I worked the off season in the winter. Then I started developing things and nothing, you know, I was starting to learn about the lifts. I went to Moreau High School. I knew I needed to get better at the lifts. And I had, first of all, Jim Schmidt, who was involved in Olympic lifting. He came over and helped me and I worked on it and got better. And then I brought in Rush Nip, world record holder at one time in the press at his weight class, learned more. I brought in the late Carl Miller, learned more. Also, Don Chu was right above me. And I had read Fred Wilt's article and either Scholastic Coach or the other one, I can't coach an athlete, one of the two, there's Scholastic Coach about plyometrics. And I looked at it first, then I reread it and started to do some of the things. And I asked Don and he graciously came in and helped me. And we became friends. He was already, they called him Dr. Chu. So I thought he's a doctor because I'd send my kids up there and he would heal them up. We did things like I would call and say, hey, Don, we're going to combine lifting, intersperse the jumps in lifting. Well, now it's complex training. I had one article someone gave me. We did, and I can't find it. We did squats, your body weight, 60% of your body weight for 5 seconds. So when you could do that, then we would up that one day speed squats. I also had a former who was a grad assistant at Kansas State, along with me, named Gib Romaine, was at Maryland. And he got to know Frank Costello, and they were running downhill. So I brought that into Moreau in 1970s, and it's still far superior than any of all that other assisted training. And here's why. The athlete is applying the force and it's a gradual, it's not ripping them out. Now, the key to that, if you're interested, you should only speed them up about 5% for the total time of that distance. So that hill is very slight. So if you ran the 40-yard dash in 5 flat, you wouldn't want them to run faster than 4.85, 4.9 down. You know, Carmelo Bosco, who was a good friend of mine, the late Carmelo, did a study with towing. And he said, once you went faster than 5.5%, they started to stub. And, you know, and then you did it, do it fresh. We ran uphill. We did the plyos. We did in-depth jumps. And then I didn't bench press the kids last year because you don't play football laying down. Now today they grab and hold so much, it's a different game, but I had them step off a bench and block a back. So we get that in-depth block. And anyway, I had known Bill Walsh through my brother, Dick, because Bill was a grad assistant, I believe, at San Jose State. Somehow they had a connection. And he would come to Utah State and scout players. He wasn't scouting me, obviously. But so when he was at Stanford, he called me over and we talked. And then when he got the job at the 49ers, he called and offered me the job. So I did that for 4 years. I just wanted to do something else. So I started my own business. Don Chu and I did. And then I bought the business from Don. And here's the kicker. We're still friends. Very few partners break up with her. We're still my best buddy. At that time, we had done some work for the White Sox, Don and I did. And they brought me back to spring practice in 85, liked what I did. And they made me an offer to go back to Chicago and work with both teams. Bulls. And so I went back, worked for the White Sox for a couple of years, but I had 4 general managers in 4 years and it's a year and a half. So you know how that worked out. And that's a whole nother story. But anyway, I stayed with the Bulls. And all through this time, I was always asking questions, reading, bringing people. Like I said, we brought experts into Moreau High School. I brought Nip, Miller, Chu, Jimmy Schmidt. So, and I was reading. And then when I went to the 49ers, I brought in people. And then when I went to the Bulls, I actually had a budget of about $18,000 a year approximately to bring in people. And I had an equipment budget of $18,000. I never spent all that once I got what I wanted, but we spent the money. I brought in Bosco, K.O. Hockington, got Satorsky, Mel Siff, Charles Poliquin. I'm sure I'm going to miss someone and hurt someone. Rob Panarella, got to know Dr. Lutz because I got to speak at the Mayo Clinic. God, I know I'm missing people and I apologize to them who I didn't mention. But so, you know, and I kept bringing in Carl. We'd talk and then I got phone numbers and I got a lot of information. I have every copy of Yessi's Soviet Sports Review. They're now with the great young strength coach at Kansas City, Ryan Reynolds. I gave them to him. But so I acquired quite a library. And then just coaching people, you found things over the years, you know, and you went to football, everybody, you know, that was part of lifting. Now, did I get everybody to do it? No, I'm not going to make that absurd assumption because I was their first strength coach. So you got that. And then they had all that hydrogen equipment and I got rid of it and the players were all happy. So we brought all that we did snatches, cleans, jerks, squats, pulls. You know, we did their bench, we did some plyos, we did some sprinting, we did interval work. You started to use the medicine ball. And of course, I know who I haven't talked about, who I brought in a lot, Charlie Francis. I first met him in 1982. And then through the years with the Bulls, I spent lots of hours with him, gleaned so much information that was just irreplaceable. And because Charlie, he was quick and to the point, and he wasn't a him or a har. The only thing he wouldn't tell you to do is, and I've gotten the same way, exactly how to do it, because you have to adapt to your situation. But he came down many times, worked with the players, players loved them, and worked with my son. So that was a great help all through those years. You know, one of the things he said, and because people ask me, and I use his quote, there are no absolutes.
Yeah.
There are no absolutes. And just like if you want to get fast, once you have good technique and mechanics and you're strong enough, you have to run at 95%. Anything between 75 and 95 is too slow to be speed work and too fast to recover from on the off days. Mm-hmm. Now, the other thing he always said, if it looks right, it flies right. It's interesting and I'm kind of rambling. I watch people talk about acceleration. It's all of a sudden like everybody develops, you know, speed's a brand new thing. In the 60s, and when I was coaching the 70s, we always said if you couldn't run, you couldn't play. Because all those coaches had come from when they played both ways. Mm-hmm. You know, we all did speed work. And like it's now, it's like, oh, my God, speed work's just been found. Well, you know, man's been running fast since day one. And if he didn't, in the prehistoric times, he got eaten alive. So you didn't have any slow guys hanging around.
Yeah. Right. No, so one of my friends, just to jump in on that, he's one of the top snipers in U.S. history. Oh, and boy. he's a track and field coach, and you can look him up on the History Channel. His name's Ethan Place. And so he made some of the hardest shots in Fallujah and Iraq. And it was funny because he said after day one on the streets, he said there wasn't a fat man left because you couldn't get across his corridor that he was shooting down that alley and be able to dodge his bullets. There was only skinny guys that were on meth. But anyway, continue. I'm sorry.
Spelled like it sounds.
Place. Yeah. Like P-L-A-C-E.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I see what we're talking about. But speed. And one of the things about acceleration. I'm not trying to contradict people, but I've never seen a guy that was really strong, really powerful and elastic, not accelerate well.
Right.
Usually if you don't accelerate well, you lack one of those qualities, that or you're just totally uncoordinated. And if you're totally uncoordinated, you know, which leads me to, you know, I see people doing speed things today. I'm not going to say what they are, but I wouldn't be doing, I wouldn't put all those little things to run over. Charlie mm-hmm. always said that. Why are you putting things down for them to look at? You want mm-hmm. to run. Mm-hmm. I want them to, you know, think accelerate. Oh, I know they do. But hey, guys got, I just, sometimes I think they overcoach it and then they get some guy that's really fast and then they credit with, I'm not discouraging it. I wouldn't use it. That's my, mm-hmm. all you got to do is if you're in an NFL or one of those, and one of those guys trip and gets hurt, when you're running, what am I looking? I don't want to be looking at my feet. I want to concentrate on my mechanics. That's just me personally. That's just my personal philosophy.
You're discussing wicket runs with like the mini hurdles or sticks and the rotary runs and all that. Yeah.
Yeah. Just here. What is your bound? Can you speed bound? Can you single leg hop quick? Are you really like a pogo stick? Other words, what's your reactive strength index? What? Here's the other thing people should look at. Okay, you got a guy that squats 200 kilos. Okay, can he clean 70% of that or power snatch 55% or whatever? Then the other thing to look at is how far he throws a medicine ball forward between his legs and over the back. Carl Valley makes a great point. You have to unlock, you know, in other words, you got to unhinge. And look, so if you're good at the heavier, but when you get in and throwing the medicine ball is more acceleration because you're Olympic lifting is an impulse and then you're getting under the bar. The medicine ball throws, you're accelerating all the way through the throw. And so you want
to look like, all the way through to the distal joints is what you're saying. So we're not automatically like shortchanging the movement. We're moving all the way through.
Well, you don't shortchange the Olympic, but it's one impulse. And then you're through, you know, you are pulling under with your arm. But what I'm saying, you want to look at those parameters. Now, if a guy's not good at throwing that lighter implement, maybe you spent too much time with him. Other words, here's another example. Let's say you have a person that can do a standing long jump of 8 feet. That's your average. What can they do 5 for? How quick are they with it? And what's their distance? So if they can't come close to equaling 40 feet in 5 jumps, they don't transfer acyclical power or less to repetitive or cyclical. And then you have the alternating, the bounds.
Right.
And then the other thing is you have the ankle jumps, and a real good way to measure there's all kinds of way to measure reactive strength. Don Chu and I did that back starting in about 1980. We'd have kids step off an 18-inch box and jump up, and we look at the ground time and their height, and we divide it out. We just never gave it a name.
Right.
I didn't know. And in fact, the interesting thing, I tested a kid one day. He was a world champion barefoot skier. And he came in off that 18-inch box and got off the ground at 0.172 and jumped high. I'm going, huh? And Don said, well, think about it. It's a constant impulse when you're on that barefoot. So I always became interested in it. And in the 80s, Don and I started to develop a timing device. And I finished it when I was in Chicago. And I could measure change of directions and speed and this reactive strength index. And we would do that at the Bulls. And a simple way for coaches to do this, and this is Carlo Vittori, who I also met, who just passed away in Italy. I got to spend some time with him, and he would have, let's say you do a counter movement jump using your arms, and let's say you jump 24 inches. He felt for speed, for sprinters, you should be able to come very close to that height with a repeat jump of 10. In one of those or two of those jumps, you should be able to come close, jump close to that height in a time of 1.175 or under. Now that's one way to do it. Then you can just do the repeat jump with your hands on your hip and look at, but I think if all those parameters are in line, I don't see how you can accelerate well. And I read all the mechanics. I've just never saw anybody that was, let's call it sprint fit, sprint condition, that didn't run fast. And that's just, you know, maybe I'm making simple. And when I was talking about testing, I think one of the things that's overlooked, I never see anybody ask the most obvious, the most important test. And everybody says, what is it? Can they frickin' play? Because if they can't play, there isn't a damn thing. I don't care what you do with the reactive strength, Olympic lifts, sprinting, you know, plyometric. It isn't going to make any difference because they don't have instincts for the game. I've seen basketball players come to the Bulls who could jump out of the gym, couldn't play basketball. They passed all the physical tests, great, but they had no instincts for the game. And I've seen guys that we would call good athletes be able to play because they could anticipate things. They understood where to be on the court. I think the guys you're going to really help are those middle guys. If you get someone who's a superstar and willing to work, all the better. You know, the Horace Grants, the Scottie Pippins, who we were fortunate to work with. And all the guys we worked with who were at the Bulls and 49ers. I never really had unpleasant moments, to say the least. All the guys were, you know, good. You know, there were guys that didn't work with me, but they were pleasant. But at the Bulls, you know, they all, and now Scottie sometimes worked with them, but in his informative years, he all worked. And the interesting story, in 1997, he had surgery late and he was hurt. So he wasn't going to be ready. And someone said, well, this other person rehabbed. And someone sitting at the table nudged me, Jimmy Stack, and said, Al, aren't you going to say anything? I said, no, you'll come back in November. Come off the West Coast road trip. Scotty said, I said, sure. And he was a great guy. And all those guys, they're people. And one of the big mistakes everybody makes, don't treat them any different. The first key thing you have to do, I don't care whether it's high school. When I was at Murrow High School, you've got to get the trust and build a relationship. People always ask me, what's my favorite championship, the NBA or NFL? I said, neither. And they go, what one? Murrow High School. Those championships. Those young men played for the spirit of the game. And, you know, they're young, idealistic, and so uplifting to me.
Very attractive about the front end of that, right? I mean, it's just there's something that really is empowering.
You're not worrying about your contract and you know, thinking of negotiating that. I think the other thing is I'm basically a high school coach. I've had several guys tell me that. I'm just basically a high school football coach. In fact, Randy Cross, we're going to the Super Bowl, one of the newspaper writers in the Bay Area asking about me. And he said, he's a teacher. And he said, I wouldn't be surprised to see him go back to high school. You know, that's just who I am. You know, I just, for what it, and now did I enjoy it? Working with the players and the championships? Absolutely. I'd be lying. But in terms of a deeper sense, financial, a glorification of who that you get, like people give me all these things. And I said, you know, I was the same guy that the Bulls before and after when we didn't win championships. I said, the difference was the players, same with the 49ers. But so that's kind of how my career, the people I've met, you develop things. It's like single leg training. Well, we had a player with the 49ers that had a groin problem. So not being, you know, I said, well, let's do split squats. And that always helped. After I left the Niners, I saw him on a plane a couple of years later, accidentally. I said, you're doing the split squats every time I groin. So single leg training isn't new. In fact, that Bulgarian split squat, there's pictures from years ago of people doing that stuff. You know, someone gave it a name and I knew, I'm trying to think of his name. All of a sudden, the gentleman that brought it here, I got a blank. Anyway, I know him. I've been to Texas and watched him train. And he brought that over. And, you know, he stayed at my house and I spent time with him in the late 80s. And when I went to see him, they weren't doing it. They were doing plain old squats. So I think people in Beans were talking about bilaterals. I think you need both. I don't think you want to get carried away. What I see people do, they have a tendency to get so locked into something, they're so locked in they can't break out of it.
When I'm listening to you talk, I feel like you're very comprehensive in all of these different types of things that you're trying to do. Like you're like, hey, look, these training methods have worked for a really long time, but let's dial in what we're doing with these particular training methods at the right time. Yeah, and with who? Right.
It's when, what, how much, and to whom. And what I'm saying, we did with one of the players, we had some single leg, because the only thing he could do was what I love. One of my favorite single leg exercises is a reverse step down. You start from the top and you barely let your toe. It's eccentric. And Dragomir was the first one to show me. And he had Horace do a set of 10 where Horace could, your legs. And so we did that with one of the players. A spaz off with a gentleman that brought that over the other. But so I don't get so locked in I'll tell you what, probably the best single leg, and it's not true single leg, is lunges. Because with the lunge forward, you have to do what? You have to decelerate, stabilize that knee and push back. So if you're really talking about really working on that being a big factor, the other one I like single leg RDLs. Now, I'm not going to do single leg cleans, and I see people making a circus act out of it and standing on a physio ball and everybody's unstable. The problem, you get too unstable, your body's so focused on stabilizing, you're not building any strength. And people say, well, now they got stable strength. Yeah, you put 100 kilos on them, they fall through the floor. Now, one of the things I do that upsets some people is if they ask, someone asked me, would you rather have an athlete who weighs 100 kilos that could single leg squat 100 or bilateral squat 200. I said, I'll take the 200 guy because it won't take me long to train them to do the 100. The other thing they don't understand, when you do that single leg squat, your hips are not open. So you're not working. You can get by with not good hip rotation. You're not going to strengthen that adductor.
Right.
And the other thing is, you're not going to, that axial loading, there are three things that create bone density: in-depth jumps, squat jumps, and axial loading from squatting. And you want, over time, now you don't want to, I see guys get carried away a little bit. That will create bone density. So, and when I do single leg work, I would recommend you do it right after your bilateral, because you've activated everything, do three sets and get out. Now, when I was at Murrow High School, the only single leg stuff we did is squats. No, excuse me. We did sprinting, bounding, single leg hops. Sprinting is the ultimate single leg exercise. You know how many knee surgeries I had on the varsity? 1 in 6 years. You know how many I had in the whole program? Whole program. Two.
Wow.
Maybe one other. One maybe after I left, there might have been another JV get one I didn't know. Mm-hmm. But we didn't do any of that. But the thing we did is we hit in practice. You can't learn to take a punch playing touch football. And that's the biggest mistake they're making. The other thing is we practice at a high tempo. So we didn't have pulled hamstrings. They were used to it. They were also in very good condition. The other thing we did, every drill in the off season, when we moved stations on our 30-second station, changing direction and all that, we broke down and got in hip position. We did that at practice every time you switch drill. And on defense, I had a drill where the first whistle would stop whatever kind of contact, whether it's full. The rest of the defense had to break down and move in and circle the ball carrier.
Mm-hmm.
And the purpose was, I said, I want that guy to look up and see 11 green jerseys. The other thing is they're always breaking down. And when they do, when we break down between drills, they'd run and then I'd give them a wave. They had to move. And then we did our change of direction. And I find it interesting, people taking things we did for granted. Now they give them a turn, deceleration training. Every time you caught a clean snatch or jerk, you're decelerating. Every time you squat, you're decelerating. Every time we did our change of direction, every time we did our pliers, every time we broke in, we probably decelerated thousands of times. And we didn't call it that. And running downhill, you really are trying to control. I think people give it names and now they plan for just have a training program.
Right.
Do these things. I won't say who read the other day, said, well, some people say there's nothing new. There aren't, I don't think, many new quote exercises. What's new is the scientists who are about 10 years behind the coaches are telling us, well, why this is how it works and why it works. Mm-hmm. My eyes told me. My experience, here's the other thing, my experience as an athlete, and I knew in college that I wasn't as good an athlete because I did so much upper body stuff that I hurt my coordination. I really did. I didn't realize it at the time. And I did an Olympic lift that I didn't know how. We didn't do plyos. I sprinted. Thank God I did that. So they may put the wicket run out and think that's new, but if you probably went back 6,100 years, you look at what the ancient Greeks did, a lot of the stuff. I've got stuff from the 1800s where guys are jumping single leg squat, doing all the medicine balls. I think too many people want to, I shouldn't say too many, some people are promoting themselves so much on the internet, so they have to come up. It's like this model car is better than the last one. It's like golf clubs. Oh, this year it's going to hit it further. Then you see guys online take clubs 5 years ago, it hits it no further. The only difference, the new club's a little straighter. So
right.
There's obviously new interpretations of things, a little difference in planning. I also read for someone, and I'm going to whiz them off, but I'm flat think this guy doesn't have a clue. He said, all that fourth quarter conditioning after practice and during training, you can't teach mental toughness. BS. You can teach it. If you're demanding, those kids make a decision. And when they're in a group, they don't want to quit. It's like the Marines.
Right. Well, and I always say the same thing, Al. I mean, I talk about this a lot, and you know that, I actually am a little bit of a, I would be, I guess if people were going to be critical of me, they'd say I'm a little bit higher volume guy than others. And when I was coaching football, same idea, before I had opportunity to take another head coaching position, doing kind of coaching cross country and tracks, so I had my girls all year round. So I could put together that comprehensive program. But when I was coaching football, the kids would be like, well, where are we going to do this stuff? What are we going to do that stuff? I said, my job is to make you stronger, faster, and more agile, period. We're going to have football season to do all these other things. But sometimes they're like, well, I don't understand why we're doing this type of work. This is like really draining. And, you know, we're not going to, and it's like, because we've got to go to the point where you're about to feel like you're going to break and we're going to be able to push past it.
Yes.
And then you know that you can get there. And that's one of those things where you're like, oh, we don't want to do this or that. It's like, but that's the only way they learn. Like if you look at Paris Island, when they're doing all the SEAL training and they're doing this, a lot of it is just literally like embracing the suck. This is going to suck. It's going to be really uncomfortable, but we are going to get through it together. And if you don't break, we will be mentally tough. Mental toughness doesn't come out of magic, right?
You're mentally tough before you're physically tough.
Correct.
And if you're not exposed to that, and these people that say that they can't, they never played football for my brother because he saw kids change, and they never played football for me. We had 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
And those kids, we're in Moreau High School. We were going to win in the fourth quarter. And I picked that up from Vince. And you convince and you tell kids you're working hard and they know it. And, you know, they paid the price. But if you don't pay a price, and today's athletes, they all know everything. Too many of them. They think they do. But, you know, the problem is they don't let you coach anymore. They named the new, they redid the football, soccer field, and track, really a nice complex in Moreau High School. And I was honored that they named it after me. And the principal said, you know, your former players really wanted this. And he said, unfortunately, guys like you couldn't coach today. They don't demand anything. They're a bunch of snowflakes. Football will be a tough game today. It'll be a tough game 50 years from now. And I didn't want guys that are going to quit. I didn't want anybody in that field that was going to quit. And people say, oh, you can't do it. You don't make them tougher. You either never played the game, which you obviously haven't, and you've never been around enough kids to see what you can demand. Did some kids not turn out because they didn't want to pay the price? Great. I didn't want those guys.
Right.
There were some good guys, but they didn't want to pay that price. They didn't want to work out. They didn't, So anyway, I think people that make those statements.
It drives me nuts.
I would just love to line up them because we'd knock their ass right off the ball. And we'd shove it down their throat. We would drive the football to 90 something yards. I had a freshman team in a championship game drive at 90 yards, which is unheard of. But anyway, got me off of my
pet. No, we're good. And I would say, you know, the interesting thing that you bring up there is like at the end of the day, it's still a tough game. And if everybody's talented, there's other things that then have to be done to win. So I always say, like, look, you recruit the best kids out of your school that are really athletic, but you nerf everything, you make it weaker, you make it lighter, so you can attract the quote unquote more talented kid. But then at the end of the day, if everyone else is adhering to that philosophy, then their athletes are going to be just as good or talented as your athletes. So then how do you create points of separation? It's from work that elicits mental toughness that eventually when push comes to shove, they're going to be more prepared. They're going to be robust. They're going to be able to handle the bad little things that are going to come up that aren't perfect because every sport, you know, you have to compete when things aren't perfect.
Just remember this. There was only one perfect man that walked this earth, if you have that belief. And you saw what happened to him. So I don't think that, you know, we're not going to be perfect. And you gradually increase the intensity so they can adapt. You don't go out there. Now, I'm not one of those guys the first day you go out and they can't walk and all that stuff. No,
you're gradually.
But the other thing, those kids that can't take that you allow in their team, maybe they're good. They go to college. Somewhere along the line, they're going to be a coach killer.
Right.
They're going to be a coach killer. And you talk about toughness. You look at Belichick. What's he say? I asked Dick why he's so successful. They do what they're supposed to do better than anybody else.
Right.
They do it. That's toughness. Mentally, I'm going to do. I'm assigned, and I'm going. And if they don't, Belichick lets them know.
Right.
You know. I just. a whole different philosophy out there today. I'm so glad I'm not coaching. I tell my old guys, I said, I wish I could go back and get you when you're at that teenage years and put that team together. And all these guys throwing the ball over the lot. I said, I wonder how they'd see if someone really got down and blocked it and that old crowd their sled. Yeah. I said, now they're all standing up. Well, anyway, that's it in the past.
Well, and I find it, so circling back a little bit, do you think that, I mean, because you've been in the NFL, you've been in the NBA, that there's this big hesitation to push because they're like, well, we never want an athlete to get hurt in practice, but we can find it acceptable that they get hurt in competition.
I'm not around it, so I would be.
Yeah.
I think there's always going to be some of that. It always has been.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of the problem is football. And I see all these high school kids getting injured and knee surgery. I don't think they practice hard enough. In mm-hmm. other words, you're a track coach.
Right.
What would happen to your 100-meter man or girl that ran 800s all week and then went to the meet? Do you think she'd be ready? Or he? Do you think over time they may pull a hamstring? You've got to practice at enough intensity that relates to the game, because nothing can relate. People talk about specificity. The game is the most specific. Practice is specific, but if you're the starter, you're playing against the second team. You don't have the, mm-hmm. you don't have at the upper levels, college and professional, you don't have the scrutiny of the press, the fans. So the stress at a game, when you're at a game, that's a whole new level. In other words, even if you took your kids out there and you ran the 40, you said, okay, today we're going to run 40s against the other team, their times would be better.
Right.
So I just think, preparation, and what gets me back to the bottom of my pyramid, work capacity. You've got to be in shape, and there's no cute way to get them in shape. Jeez, we can't. They all want to dance around everything. Get in shape,
right?
The only thing I don't like about football, the rule changes have allowed certain positions to become. I don't think they're fit people.
Yeah,
and I don't think they're a good example. And if you had to go back and they had to cover kickoffs and play both ways, they couldn't play football. If you went back and played football in college both ways, all of a sudden those 300-pound guys went right back to 240.
Right.
The great Billy Cannon, people ought to look this up, the Halloween run. He makes it against Ole Miss. He scores a touchdown, puts him ahead. Late in the game, Ole Miss is on the 3-yard line. Guess who stops him on fourth down? Billy Cannon, because he played both. He was, one of the first guys, Alvin Roy, was working with Paul Dietzel at LSU. And one of the first guys to really lift that whole team. And, it was a different game. And now it wasn't as exciting as today. There's no question about it. But I just, the conditioning factor has gone out of football. Guys, they substitute this guy. When I was at Utah State, we had 33 guys we traveled with. Now, I played all the special teams defense would play. And then we only traveled with 5 linebackers. It was different. And it was just, that was the first year. And it took the coaches a while to catch up what you could do, specialization and all that. And, it makes the game exciting, no question about it. And the athletes are bigger, faster, and stronger. There's no question about that at all. So, in terms of, like I said, if they can't play, nothing you're going to do. So the first and most important test, can they play? Then if they can play, can they run fast? Well, if they can run fast, they can jump high. They have a good reactive strength index. And if they can play, they can change direction. Now, I would test their speed. I'll tell you the test we did. And then we do change direction, just for change. And then we do overhead squat. I see all these, we did all the hamstring stretches and all that stuff. If you got a guy that can take a stick or a gal, if you can overhead squat, and at the bottom of that, press it, they've got all the mobility and flex. You don't need to test. Well, how about thoracic extension? Well, you can't get in that bad position. What about shoulder flexibility, lat extensibility? What about hamstring squats? You've got it. Now, if they can't, then you back it up. Can they squat? And then you break it down from there. And then the other thing we did is we would do the squat jump, the counter movement, the reactive test. I also did a step close. Because when you have a good reactive score with a step close, you're probably fast because you convert from linear to horizontal. And then the coaches did their thing. One other test you could put in is the 90-second box test. You're on a 12-inch box. You stand to the side and you do it for 90 seconds. You want to see who's got a heart because that test will break you down. That'll, as my good friend Al Miller said, that'll make a bulldog hug a hound, you know. But
so then it sounds like we're getting to kind of a bit of the conversation of your pyramid of development,
yeah,
right? And we're talking about the comprehensiveness of this. We're talking about the different tests. So talk to the audience kind of how you constructed this period, this pyramid of development that that attacks all of these different things that you're mentioning.
Well, I actually drew it up, I think, originally someplace in the late 80s or early 90s. I can't remember. And when I had to speak in Italy for their basketball association in 96 is when I finally started to formalize it more, I believe. And it was just a way to organize training as a high school football coach. How you taught everything was from the basics and then you worked up. So when I was, we ran the Houston split back veer. So the first one we taught was the inside veer. Then we taught the outside veer. Then we taught the counter dive. If we taught tackling, I put you in the most perfect position. When I had a tackling drill, and all you young football coaches, you want to have good tacklers, make every drill the tackler has success. Well, why do you want? Because that's tackling is confidence. It's like hitting. So if you had batting practice off Nolan Ryan, you would have no confidence. So, you know, that's, you know, everything started from how we taught football. First, you got in a good stance and how you hit the sled. So everything evolved. And actually, my dad was a fundamentalist. He coached until they found out he didn't have a degree. He played. So anyway, I learned that concept and he did the same. And as he was a brilliant mechanic, he's in the Sprint Car Hall of Fame racing. So that foundation and then being around Dick is where I picked the concept up for making tackling a positive. When I was in college, we had a great running back, later played in the pro, rushed for 1,000 yards with Green Bay, MacArthur Lane, the late MacArthur Lane. And they would, in spring practice, he'd get down here, he'd run over some bags. I had to do a shoulder roll and tackle him full speed, one-on-one. He weighed 220, I weighed 195. I mean, it was one-on-one and there was no way. You talk about mental toughness, there was no way. You got all these guys looking, what are you going to do?
Right. Nowhere to hide.
Nowhere to hide. See, that's mental toughness. You give them nowhere to hide and you find out. So we banged each other around, but that's not a drill that would build a great confidence, but for either party. So I think when I went to the Bulls, I basically, and this is going to sound funny, I looked at, after I was there and got a little feel for things, they had jumped all their life. They didn't need to do more plyometrics. You know, people say, well, let's get them to jump and touch the top of the backboard. You only got to jump about 5 inches over the rim to stuff it, to get a rebound. Rebounds aren't got up here. Bill Russell always said rebounds in the regular season are got below the rim and then the playoffs are above the rim. But and let's face it, by the time they're 20s, the chances of improving their elasticity has already been developed. We did some sprinting, but what we did is we lifted. People say, what else? We lifted. We did pulls, planar snatch pulls, RDLs, squats, front, back, safety bar, belt squat, whatever they could adapt to. We did power snatch, power clean, push press, push jerk, jerk. Again, what they could do and how we put them together. Some guys, we let them bench because they like to bench and do curls and all that stuff. They did. But and people said, why'd you do it? Because it's the one thing they had been exposed to and would give us the biggest bang. They weren't strong. Now, if they came in there and were like football players, and that's, you know, you get probably from a good college program, you're probably not going to make a big difference in the strength. You want to maintain it. You know, it's a different ball of wax. We did Charlie Francis's tempo and medicine ball. And then I adapted where we would throw the ball at one end of the gym 20 times, stride down the other 20, and we'd do a set of 10. We called it med ball tempo. So we did medicine ball tempo, lifted, did some sprint work, did a little jumping with certain people, but that's what we did. And we did it 5 days a week. Now, we didn't do everything 5 days a week. There were some guys that trained, lifted 5 days a week. Mm-hmm. And they were dedicated. I remember one 4th of July, we had about four or five in, and one right before we won the first championship, Labor Day, we had seven or eight guys in training on Labor Day. Now, I couldn't make them come in. These guys wanted to win. I'm no great psychologist. And people can tell by listening, I'm no great motivator. I'm known to have any magic wand, and I'm not going to write a dissertation how I did this and I did that. The players do it. And that's the one thing coaches got to remember. It's about them. I don't care if you're the head coach or you're the lowest common denominator. It's about them. And too many people, oh, it's about me. No, it's about them. You didn't make anything. You just helped polish whatever God-given talents they had. You didn't put something there that wasn't there. Now, the mental toughness issue, you can make them make some decisions. But so that's how I came up with the pyramid, because I started looking at all this and tried to come up with an organized way. In fact, I'm working, going back through it and taking each section and making a video explaining just in the section how you might manipulate it. So for example, you come to the strength section and you've got a person that's not strong enough. Well, gee whiz, he's got to run too. And that's in there. You manipulate the volume, and the way you first manipulate the volume, I put volumes there, which is not really good, is look at the total time. So as you get close to the season, let's say you're spending 5 hours a week lifting, maybe you drop your lifting to three, so you're still emphasizing, but you're doing enough speed work so they're ready. It's just a shell game, and you're moving it around. And so I'm going to explain each cycle, kind of how you can manipulate it to based on the individual. So, for example, if you're an explosive strength, and the guy's strong, cleans that, but he doesn't do very well in standing long jumps or repeat jumps, or he can't throw the medicine ball, then you just shift the emphasis. It's still an explosive strength, but you're shifting an emphasis. That's how you individualize. People think, oh, I got to have a different. I went through this. I went all through this. This is what I know. I spent a whole year and a half wasting my time doing something. You individualize by basically emphasizing the quality that you think they either lack, or you emphasize a quality that will lead to the quality they need. For example, if you can't run fast and you're weak and you're not explosive, you're not going to be good. Going out and sprinting more isn't going to help. Now, you're also going to get the athlete, hey, I don't have to lift. I run 4.4, or, I'm fast. I can jump high. Yeah. How strong? Oh, I don't need to be strong. You're a ligament-dominated athlete. So you're going to depend on that. And as fatigue sets in, you're going to get tendonitis, overuse injuries. And the fact that you don't have the strength to back that up and take you through the season and protect you from injury, because muscles are the shock absorbers of the body. So when those guys come up with those kind of scenarios, no, everybody needs to be strong.
And
some people try to, this guy, he's an exception. Yeah, he's lucky.
Right. Right. And that's one of the things that, like, I've talked a lot about recently, and I've been beating the drum on. The 40 time is nice. It tells you some things. It needs to be accurate, though. Now what they're doing is with all these pro days, they've got people, without the laser timers, without the computer times. They're like, oh, this guy ran this. And it's like, well, back 40 years ago, that would be impressive because everyone's running on a similar margin of error.
Yeah.
But now that we have these machines that can measure that out accurately, and those significant figures get fudged with, I'm uncomfortable. The other thing I want people to focus on, this is a big thing that I've been beating the drum on, is momentum, the momentum score. So you're taking their weight and their size and that speed. That, to me, the combination in that formula, way more impressive to me for contact sports like rugby and football and basketball than just being fast.
Yeah, my grandson plays rugby, and I saw someone I saw someone from Australia had a little video on how to tackle in rugby. Well, it's the way I learned to tackle until I learned to put my head in there. Now they can't do that anymore. But when I played junior college and college football, we put the numbers right in there. When I was coaching high school, we taught it that way until we couldn't. We call it put a hat on. But, you know, they can't do that anymore. But that's the way it was. But, you know, I think if you look at the pyramid, everything is a progression. And if you look, it's really simple. What's your work capacity? Can you do big tempo and 800 medicine balls over a couple of weeks without falling apart? If you can't, you don't have any basic general conditioning. Can you do Javorek's complex for a male, 40 to 50% of your body mass to, and depending on your height, you might cut it to 4 repetitions. I mean, that's a simple thing. So everybody talks about stability. Your stability goes out the window as soon as you get tired. I learned that from Mark Comerford's a guy I spent a lot of time with. And I spent time with a guy named Michael Shacklock, a lot about nerves and guides and stuff. And Jeff Coverley and a bunch of other people on PTs. And the thing is, so the pyramid was a progression to make people look at, and what are your tests for each of these areas? If you've got a guy that's King Kong already, well, you don't have to spend 5 hours a week lifting. So if you've got a guy that's already doubling his, and they, I think Mike Stone and some other people, George Half, have done studies. If you squat 2.1 something of your body weight, your chances of injuries are much less. Well, think about the axial loading, this overall body development that you have to have. So then where are they? Okay, well, they need to do more elastic work. Okay, then in the pyramid, I give you, okay, here's how much time I think you would need for strength. But none of it is an absolute. It is my vision of what I think. If I was in a different, I would manipulate that differently because I'd have a real person. It's not an app. It's just a way of looking at it. And I've seen some guys on YouTube have actually used it and how they explain it. It's just a kind of a system that you can manipulate. It's not an app. There's no absolute system. And that's when you start saying, well, my training system's the best. No, it's not. It's not. I think there are guidelines. So I don't think you can get out here and be doing all this aerobic work. I don't think you can get strong lifting a lot of light weights. I think you're not going to get faster just by running if you have no background. You know, I don't think you can get carried. What you have to do is not get carried away with any one part of your program. What you have to do is, what do this group of athletes need? What do they need? And when I went to Bulls, I was fortunate. They all needed the same thing. And that's, so if you got those people stronger, you were going to see some results because they not have been exposed to it. They went from squatting nothing to whatever they could handle decently. You know, John Paxson squatted 360, I think. Horace squatted 360. Horace cleaned 300 off the 6-inch box. He could have done more. That's the other thing. I never very, very rarely took anybody to a true maximum. Randy Cross jerked, I want to say, 350 off the rack or 375. Well, he was a great high school shot putter. I didn't make him do that. His body, he already could do that. I mean, by training, he had that quality. So I just, again, it's just, it's kind of like putting an offense or defense in. It's just a plan and you manipulate it the way you want. It is it the ultimate? No, it's just the way I think.
So did you feel that this philosophy that developed into somewhat of a structure with mindful, comprehensive, good training to elicit certain responses within whatever gap that they had? So you're like covering gaps. Hey, they're over here. They're doing great. They've got this. Their numbers are great. But this over here is a glaring weakness. Yeah. And then how do we set up training to attack those gaps? Is that part of what you've got going on?
Basically, it's like a defense in football. They can't cover everything. Where's your weakness in that defense? And you have to know it.
Love that.
And you know, and when that offensive formation comes up, you have to change or whatever, who you're playing. Yes. And all I'm saying is, at the Bulls, we hadn't gotten guys to train. Now, the 49ers, we did. And I was just, I was only 34 years old when I went to the 49ers. There were players right. as old. And, you know, so, and I had trained them the way I trained my high school players, basically. And so it was just, it's just a way to look at things. It's covering the gaps. The other thing you got to know, here's one thing important. The shorter the time to execute the athletic skill or the training methodology, especially the ground contact, the more it depends on genetics. So you may get a guy that's never going to be super elastic. And when you work on him, here's what I found with those people. We did more Olympic lifts off blocks. So they had to go all or nothing. So there was no wind up, because people that are not as explosive, if you watch them back, want to wind up. So if you put the bar on the block, or you take and pause the push press or push jerk, you can't wind up. So you give them, you adapt things that they can do. If you've got someone that, you know, we trained some guys who were never going to be elastic. You know, they were 270 pounds and they never were. So we know you can get them stronger. And we know you can do the lifts. Obviously, the lifts start to require more speed. But give them things they can accomplish. If they're never going to be able to do this over here, if it's something they need to do in terms of conditioning or having a game like speed, you got to do enough of it. But to go do a bunch of box jumps with someone who's not elastic, and all you're going to do is hurt them. Now, you could put the box way down and give them a chance. One of the things I think people don't emphasize enough is the lower leg. And reading Verkhoshansky stuff and coming to my own conclusions. And again, I go back to my own training. When I was training in high school, we did calf raises standing. We did them donkey raises. We did on a leg press machine. We didn't do seated. Unfortunately, we didn't do ankle jumps. And so I think there's a progression for the lower leg. I think you should do seated calf raises, standing calf raises. I think you do calf raises unloaded, where you, once you get the mobility to do that, and you get up on the stairs, and you, over time, you let that heel drop faster and faster. It's pretty tuned. That heel goes boom, back up, pops up. We Rob Panarella nicknamed them ankle pops, or heel pops, ankle pops. And then eventually you can do them on one leg. Now, if you got a guy with Achilles problem, I mean, you just can't throw it. This is Charlie Francis talking. You just can't throw out that blanket to everybody. And then you do your ankle jumps in place. One of the things we did, we would do some, and I try, the people listening, try this. Take an athlete doing ankle jumps, assist them about five or six. Tell them to keep going after you let go. They will do jump a little higher when they normally, because now they've learned to eccentrically handle the overload. Now, you don't do that right out of the box. And then the other thing you start with, jump rope, double under. You see all the those kids in the inner city do that. I think that's a great thing. The other thing, you start, once you can do ankle, you start on a box and you step backwards. It's like a backward drop jump and hit and pop back up, but you're not allowed to bend the knees to get on that box. See, all that's that spring. And then you do ankle jumps forward. You can use hurdles, but I was at some place and I said, why do you got the guy worrying about, you got him worried about clearing the hurdles instead of doing it. That's the same thing with the wicked run. You've got him concentrating on that. I'm sorry. I know I'll get some heat on this. That's all right. I'll line my guys up. You can play. So I just think, that's just an area people don't emphasize enough. And when you look at it, they've proven the reactive strength index. I mean, when your foot's on the ground, you don't have that time. You get so, the calf, here's the other thing. The foot is the first decelerator. So you want strong feet. Then the calf, and,
right.
and calf, Achilles, and soleus. Well, if they're not in the doing their job and you're playing basketball, where's that stress go to? The knee.
Wherever the weak spot is, right? In the knee, typically,
is the
right?
Next joint
right.
up.
Right.
Or the hip. But so, you know, I should have done a better job at the Bulls even doing that. But if you think about it, this is the first shock absorber. So if for no other reason, and you're in a sport that gets a lot of patella problems, you want this to absorb. Doesn't mean you have to be able to jump out of the gym, but it has to be strong, elastic, and it has to be reactive. It has to anticipate. The one thing about doing the jumps even for kids that aren't good at it, it teaches you to anticipate the ground. So I think there's an area that people could, I could have done a better job, and I'm sure other people can. What else you got there, Coach?
you've covered so much ground. I mean, it's been, this is awesome.
Your audience probably went to sleep.
Well, no. And then the thing is it's one of those things where you're touching on, you go to this, they do this. Now we move to this. Now you're comfortable with this. Move to this. There's a gap here. Here's the progressions. Here's the different ideas. I did have one. I've got two questions for you before we finish up here. The one is, you talked a lot about different people who you've kind of used synergistically to pull more information, to educate your athletes, to educate the people that you worked with, and to educate yourself. What did those people have that made them really attracted to you, where you were like, I want these people to come in. I want to learn from them. What did they have in common? What was a common denominator for them?
I'll give you my brother's quote when people questioned him why he had Hall of Fame coach Sid Gilman, one of the great passing coaches. He was the one that really developed the passing game. He said, why would you hire a guy like Sid Gilman? He said, I want to hire people that know something I don't. I brought people in because they knew something I didn't. And I let them work with the players. And one of the players told me, a couple of them said, you know what? That's what we like. You never let your ego get in the way. I wasn't scared of being wrong. I wasn't scared of making a mistake. And, you know, I remember we brought Charles Poliquin in. I had a kid push pressing. And I'd looked at him, and he did it better than anybody else, you know, so that becomes your model. He said, Al, he's got to get his chest and his elbows up. I said, Jesus, you're right, Charles. You know, I looked at it so much. But it didn't offend me. The thing is, I think ego ruins more people than it helps. And I think, you know, and it's even, there are a lot of coaches I disagree with, but if they do something I think fits into my thought or makes me stimulate and say, hey, maybe I'm wrong, I'll make that change. I'll do whatever it takes to help the person I'm working with. And I know I probably offended some of the listeners out there with some of my comments. Just me. That's just who I am. I don't think if you don't offend people, you never stood up for something. I read it where Paul Newman said, I don't know if it was after he passed away or before, he was quoted as saying, if you don't, I don't remember the exact, but he said, if you haven't made some people upset with you, you never stood for anything.
And that's so true. And some of the people that I trust the most aren't the people that I necessarily always get along with or agree with, because I know that they're going to tell me the things I don't want to hear when I need to hear them. And then when they tell me something I do want to hear or genuinely give me a nod or an attaboy, I actually, that has value, because I know that they truly believe it. They're not just blowing smoke, you know, up my butt and being a yes man. I cannot stand yes men. I want to know if I'm screwing up, and I want to know when I'm doing well. And
I'm not laughing at you, but I'm laughing. When I was a high school coach, I had a staff that all wanted to throw the ball. Well, I didn't like throw. I wish I would have, but we could have. Now I've got it in my mind now I could have did it. But one game we went out there and went 4 for 7. I said, boy, and I was scoping, we really opened it up. And the guy said, 4 for 7. That year, the best team I ever coached, we rushed for 3,000 yards and threw for 200 and had one touchdown pass.
Oh my God. That's hilarious. Well, and that's exactly it. It's like, how are we supposed to get better if we're never challenged?
Well, I was narrow-minded, but I'll tell you a cute story. I had a young coach come to work for me, and his dad was Pat Malley, and it was Terry Malley, quarterback. I didn't use him. I apologize to Terry if he ever sees, I should have used him, should have gave him the game film so that look at that summer. Another story. But anyway, when we're getting to play our league opener, Terry says, we're going to blow these guys out, to my team captain, Greg Blandino. Blandino looked at him and said, no, we're going to beat them about 14-0, 14-7. We're going to play great defense. And that's what we won.
Right.
Because I believed you won on defense. And defense was easier to play in those days because the offense couldn't do certain things. But
right.
I just think, you're never so good. My dad's favorite saying, you're never so good you can't get better. Mm-hmm. Be humble enough to recognize what you don't know. It's what you think you know but don't know that gets you in trouble. And if you and if you don't realize what you don't know, you can't get better. And you know, I'm still learning. I mean, I learn. I talk to Carl Valley a lot. I talk to Rob, to Don, to Johnny, to Al. When Charlie was alive, I read a lot. I look on Twitter and I get to read the different things and the research and things. But go back to the basic, the fundamentals that got people strong are the same. The same fundamentals that prepared people for athletics 50 years ago are the same fundamentals today. They may put a different name. We may be more scientific how we approach it, but they're the same things. And the fundamentals of athletes are winning. Start with an attitude. I just heard Nick Saban talk about that. And Coach Miller said, Coach Bryant said, the fundamentals are the fundamentals. If you looked at football, I asked my brother Dick, I said, how many games would you lose if you never missed a tackle?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we got a line. I said, it's not where you line up on defense, it's where you end up. Because you're not going to be able to cover everything, especially today. God, they got guys over here and they got you holding, you know, it's like playing street football, five alligators, because the guy's holding you for 5 seconds. I hate that. They've diminished the skill. They have diminished the skills of offensive line, and they don't come off the ball and really knock you off the ball. And there's nothing better. But, you know, again, I'm an old codger, and I know someone's going to write in. He was right about one thing. He is an old codger, and he'll probably say some other thing. I think it was one of the last ones I gave the Strength Coach Association. It's been a while. And I think someone wrote in a comment, when he said he was old, that was the only thing he was right about. I thought that was funny. So anyway, is there anything else that in testing or how you program is fill the gaps, but know what gaps and know how to measure those gaps. And again, I'll repeat this. Are they in shape? Okay, what's their strength? What's their high load explosive strength? What's their accelerating / low load explosive strength, med balls? What's their one jump? What's their multiple jump? How do they do alternating jumps? Lateral bounds. You know, we started doing that when I was with the 49ers, long before, you know, all that's in vogue now, all that, you know. But make them break down and get, I don't care what sport, make them break down and get in an athletic position and have to make a decision. I read one thing in ACLs that when you have to make a choice in agility drills, it puts twice the stress on the knee as when you know where you're going. So, and don't be scared to get in, as Dick said, sweat's not a bad word.
Right.
It's not scared to get in the sweat. You got to be smart. Now, if today's kids that are fast, now you got to be smart. Mental toughness is good, but you can't be stupid. You got to always, you know, you got to be smart, and you got to know who you're dealing with. You got to know. Lombardi knew Max McGee never got in the one-on-one drill. I think they used to call it the nutcracker. They can't do that.
Right.
He knew. He just stood at the end of the line. He knew each. You got to understand each individual you work with, where they're at in the team, what they think of themselves. And remember this, the backup players already know they're not as good as the first players. So give them something they can succeed at. Challenge the guys that are really good and expect their effort level. But I've seen coaches chew out or give things, oh, look at that guy can't do it. Oh, yeah, what if he has to play? Now you've convinced him he isn't any good. What if all of a sudden the starter gets hurt? You're not going to get better by being negative all the time. Right. Now, you don't have to give compliments all the time, but I think you've got to go into wherever you are as a coach. You have to be upbeat. You can't let any personal issues get in your way. You've got to go in there and you have to be you. You can't be somebody else.
And right.
You just have to be who you are and enjoy every day you coach, because when it's over, it's over.
So coach, with all these years that you've been doing this now, and you've imparted so much wisdom on the audience today, and there's so much. I know right now, just thinking about like all the stuff I've written down on this paper, I'm like, all right, I got to go back and look at that. I got to listen to that again. And it's so much great content and ideas and thoughts. So wrapping things up, if you could give anybody advice about your career, and I'm gonna pay you a compliment. I'm not gonna tell you you're right just because you're old, but you've been so successful across so many different mediums of athletic performance. What do you think, if you could impart a suggestion or idea to other strength and conditioning coaches or young people so they get out of these absolutes, what do you think made you so successful? And what about that success do you think you could impart wisdom on others coming down the line behind you?
Number one, I had great jobs and I had the opportunity to work with great athletes who were willing to work. So that's the first thing. I was in great organizations, and Brother Lawrence, who's now Father Lawrence, gave me the chance to Monroe High School to be myself. I never took a job where I couldn't be me. I had to have enough control. When I went to high school coach, I said, this is what I want to do and the way I'm going to do it. And that, you know, be yourself, realize you're never so good you can't get better. Be humble enough to realize what you don't know and go learn what you don't know. And when you're working with your players, it's not about you. It's about them. Remember, they're people just like you. And treat them as people. Build the trust that they feel they can talk to you about other things. And I've had professional athletes tell me when I was working with them and after, the one thing is they trusted me. And you can't build it. If you can't build a relationship and have that trust, you're not going to be successful. And be you. You can't be anybody else. Don't copy anybody else. Take what you think you can get. And when you build your system or how you train, don't be afraid that someone over here challenges your whole thought process. Think it through. Even if you still don't agree, go back and look at it 6 months later, like I did plyometrics. So, you know, okay, this guy, but that's what he's saying is, you know. And if you want to learn from somebody, go watch him coach. Clinic, there's a lot of good clinic speakers, but then go watch them coach and be careful. The guys, I'm doing speed now. We're doing this now. Hey, people have been running since, like I said earlier, day one. We all sprinted.
Right.
That's nothing new. We were running downhill 40 years ago. We were running uphill. We were doing plyometrics. We were doing Gerard Mox or Charlie Francis's A drills. You know, I think the mistake coaches got to make, I would look at what you could throw out. I see so many of those running drills, get rid of. What do you need to do? Not what's nice to do. What do you really need to do with this athlete?
Right.
And when I looked at an athlete, and I'll give an example, Horace Grant. He made me smart. He had a great motor. You got that cup in. Put that cup up. Put the cup up in front of the camera, the glass. All right. Let's say his strength level is right there. Now turn it upside down. Turn it upside down quickly, right in front of the camera. Boom. His strength would run out fast. We didn't have to worry about the nervous system. He had it. So all you do is have to fill it up doing the right things.
Right.
You know, basic good strength, explosive stuff, because he had the elasticity. He had the reactive strength index. You didn't have to work on that.
Right.
That was simple. Now, the next guy you get has got his, that opening's this big and he's 23 years old. Now, you got to pry that open a little bit, and then you got to get cute contrast. So they feel what, do things for the less explosive athlete that they feel explosive. You know, like I said, we did cleans off from the mid thigh, boom. Or, you know, we do different things to give them the contrast. You know, now contrast is a French contrast training I read the other day. We've been doing contrast training. We did that at Monroe High School.
Right.
We didn't put a name to it. We just did it. I did it at the 49ers. We did all the combinations. Now the people, we did all that stuff. I read the great lifter, Alexei's book. So at Monroe in the season, we would do combinations, two cleans, right, two front squats, two push. So just open your mind. Don't close it, because you are a disciple of this guy. I always tell my coaches who work for me, you're not a disciple of me. You are you. Go out there and learn more and do a better job than I did. So that's the advice I'd give.
Well, that's so great because it fits exactly what you said at the beginning. There are no absolutes. If you think they're absolutes, that's also tied to ego. It's almost like you feel like, oh, I figured it out. I've got this market cornered on this particular type of stimulus, training, workouts. And if you think that, man, that is so woefully ignorant.
Well, it's like drop-off hooks. We used them at the 49ers.
Yeah, absolutely.
I saw it in a Russian book. You know, Buddy Charnegie had done a lot of transcendent. Bud was a good guy. I got a lot from him. But the problem when you think absolutes, that means your mind's closed.
Right.
Now, maybe I'll give you a great example. Turn it on me. I don't think the wicket runs have much merit. But maybe if I went to someone who I respected doing them and he explained why, I might think about it. I might think about it. But I always go back. Here's the other thing. When I go back, here's the other thing for coaches to do. When I go back to think of speed, I think of one guy, Charlie. I go back and look at all my notes. What did he say? And when people say, well, this and that about him, I said, they were all, that's a different time. But I watched him work with Bill Cartwright. Bill Cartwright said, gee, can you get him down here more often so he can work with me and my kids? You know, some coaches would be offended, but I wasn't. So you just have to massage the athlete the way you think. But if you become absolute, it's like when I want to know something about jump training, Don Chu. That's my question. I want to rehab, Rob Panarello. I want to know something about joint mobility, Jeff Coverley. If I want to know something about Steve Lazy, Mark Comerford, Nerve Glides, Michael Shacklock. So I had these people I reach out to. They're kind of these satellites that fill in the blanks. And I had a lot of blanks in them, and I still do. And the one thing I have found, you know, as I gotten older, boy, you talk about having to get creative. I'll give something to the strength coaches that they may like. I'd lost my ability to squat because of my right knee. Mm-hmm. So I thought I was doomed. So I took the trap bar and I took it and I did put it up. So the handle was 24 inches. So it was very high. So I did some heavy, couple sets of three. Then I put it to 20 inches. Now a little lighter. Then I put it to 16 to 12. And I'm at eight, but eight, for some reason, I've got that little wink anymore and I can't get rid of it. But I was doing this. So I said, let me see squat. All of a sudden, I can squat again. In fact, I was able to squat 70 kilos for the first time in a year. Now, so if you've got a guy that's got patella problem or can't squat or you can't load him because of back, there's a thing you can do.
Right.
And a trap bar. The other thing is, I saw a lady at a gym. I call her the leg lady. She works her legs. She took a pulley off the bottom cable of a pulley machine and brought a bar or the pigtails, you know, you do the trap tricep. And she'd bring it up here and squat with it. I said, so I tried it. It keeps you more erect. And again, if you can't squat because of certain things, it's another way to do it. I actually took the trap bar the other day and did 90-pound push presses. I did three sets. Then I turned and went to my regular bar and I was able to push press 50 kilos for a double, first time in months, because it was a change. The neutral grip is easier on your shoulder. So, you know, I'm continually learning things. And you're going to make mistakes. And that's the unfortunate thing. And I, at my age, when I make them, they're painful.
Right.
The other thing I was talking to a young strength coach today. I said, if you're going to try something, and he's in college, try it first with the walk-ons. First of all, you try it so you feel it. Never put something in your program you don't know how to do, or at least one of your coaches can give you feedback. Just don't start, because if you don't have a sense, a feeling, it's hard to teach. It's hard to teach.
Well, and I always think, like, when we have these conversations and what you're describing, one of the big things that was really hard for me in my weight training and being healthy was I was always like, well, you know, I'm never going to be as strong as I used to be, or I'm going to be just, you know, getting in a fist fight with Mother Nature every day, you know, gravity, right? I'm in a freaking fist fight every day,
yes,
right? And it's like, how long can I resist that? But what I forgot, which is what you've illuminated tonight, is that the obstacle becomes the opportunity not a stopping point, right?
Yeah, yeah. You know, years ago, I had a young man I was coaching. In fact, I just talked to his brother today because he's a golf professional, and he was on a YouTube video, and I commented, and he called me. I had 230 in the bar. Now, this is many years ago. I was still in my 40s. I was squatting. He said, "Coach, I bet you used to press it." And I said, "Gabe,
yeah,
thanks. I used to build the military 230 for four reps. And now I was squatting. And now I 230, I can't even dream of lifting anyway, unless I have a car jack." But, you know, you have to. The other thing I would recommend young strength coaches, be an example. I would never hire a strength coach that physically wasn't a good example. You don't have to be Charles Atlas. I'm not saying, but if you're overweight and have bad personal habits, you're not an example. If you're going to lead, lead by example. Actions speak louder than words. I get a boot out of all these spiritual leaders for these teams. And anyway, you work on these things and you learn and you adapt. And, you know, it's like dealing with a 7-foot athlete. They didn't all pull off the floor. A lot of them didn't blow the knee. I took what they could do and built on that and not spent months trying to get something they were never going to be able to do. Right. And so I think, you know, that's the lesson, is how good are you at adapting? Right. And you know, and when you said it, when you get the roadblock, you know, I look at how much longer can I train? I've got, you know, some numbers in mind, and you know, you just have to work around it and accept it. One thing I was going to say for young strength coaches, one thing I would do to keep healthy: sprint twice a week.
Yeah.
No more than 30 yards. You can do gradual build-ups, accelerations, but I would sprint at least somewhere between 120 yards to 150 yards, to 180 yards twice a week. Nothing will keep your hip mobility of your body, even your iliums and all that, better than sprinting.
It keeps you alive and it keeps you moving and it keeps the neurological system aware, right? And there's so many benefits.
And you've got to have thoracic rotation. Uh-huh. There's a certain, yeah, all those things. And doing the running drills, it keeps you athletic.
Right.
Much more than laying down and doing a bench press. And never, never try to compete with your athletes.
Mm-hmm.
Never do that. Never, you know, and don't sit around and talk, "Well, I was playing, we did it this way." No, then they could care less. Your ancient history.
Right. So, well, they want to know what you can do for them. And that goes back to the idea of the obstacle being the opportunity, the adaptation that you're saying the athletes drive your choices. And when the athletes drive your choices, people are afraid because they feel like, well, I'm giving up control to the athletes. Like, no. You're finding the gaps, like you said, you're filling in the gaps, and then you're figuring out the way to take advantage of those gaps to make them better, which then goes back to what you said, builds their confidence. Then that allows trust to take place. And now you've done the things you need to do as a coach.
Yeah. And so everything we're saying is just common sense. But like Mark Twain said, common sense isn't very common. It's
correct.
You just go in there and do the best you can and realize you're going to make mistakes. I made them. And, you know, if I was still training guys, I would probably still make, you know, and I make the biggest mistake for myself because, I can do it. You know, it's like that old war movie, A Bridge Too Far, about when Montgomery went in there and they failed. Well, you know, you don't want too many bridges too far. I just read where Dan Pfaff said something. He'd rather be a mile short than an inch long.
Right. Yeah, that's good words.
I thought that was very brilliant. I thought those kind of statements are wisdom.
Yeah.
And what you really need to import in coaches is wisdom.
Right.
You can read all the stuff. And, you know, the other thing is, if you're in a team situation and you get an athlete that doesn't work with you, don't cut the communication. And if he comes in and is allowed to do his own thing, pretty soon he sees you giving other people attention. Every athlete wants attention. Every person wants attention. Every person, remember, everybody wants to be accepted. So,
and that's the biggest thing, is it goes back to relationships. And oftentimes people feel like, well, that's so simple, but it's the idea of, but how do you get to that point in the path, right? And the wisdom is those nice reminders in our head that help us when we've got one of those real tough decisions to make. It helps us make that decision a little bit easier.
I'll finish this thing because it's gone long.
For sure.
Two signs a coach should put in their warm. It's not about me. It's about the athletes. And I'm never so good, I can't get better. If they live by those, if they do those two things, they've got a chance.
Absolutely. Well, Al, thank you so much for being on with us. I really appreciate it. I am going to be downloading this audio ASAP, and I'm going to go back and be taking a whole bunch of notes from all the different ideas and training principles and philosophies and wisdom that you shared with us today. Is there anything that you want to share with the audience in terms of them being able to reach out to you or something you've got going on that they can be looking for in the near future?
They may look forward in the future that I may be doing for a company Zoomcast. Obviously, it'll be a financial thing because of the time commitment. And in my life at 76, I'll give you this point. I go to do coaching clinics, and I look out at the audience. I said, turn and look at the wall behind you. That's how much you got left. Then I turn around and look at the wall. I said, I'm realistic. 76, you're not going to be here forever. So it may be available. I meet with the people and we'll see where it takes us. If they don't do it, then I will do something privately. And then I'll get back with you and you can share that with you. But just keep doing the best you can and realize any type of coaching is the best life. It is, you know, you're never paid enough for your time. And I was well paid, but you're never paid enough for all the things you do. Love what you do. Enjoy those players. Enjoy the relationships, even the difficult ones. Just the ability to get up every day and go to work and then not be worked. I never worked a day in my life because I enjoyed every minute of it. Going to school, that was work. I didn't enjoy that. That was work. But anyway, I hope it helps you young coaches. And if nothing else, if you totally disagree with me, that's fine. At least I made you think.
Yep, exactly.
So that's fine. While I listened to that old codger, I wouldn't do anything. Hey, that's fine, guys. That doesn't bother me. At least I made you think about it.
Right.
So you take care, coach, and good luck to all of you.
Hey, thank you. Thank you to everybody who's been listening today. Make sure you share this conversation out. And as always, be smart, make good decisions, take care of yourself and your loved ones, and we'll see you soon. Peace out.